All right, 3, 2, 1, clap. And then you take your model and then you put your data into the model and then bingo bango, you have a machine learn. Hey there, Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Ducks Show. Bleep blorp, I'm Dave Rupert, robot, beep blorp, with me is Chris Coyer, bleep.
I feel like through your bleeps, I've analyzed them, and I can tell that you're happy, Dave. Although, bleep, the bleep, more data bleep. I have, the more accurate I'm going to be in my emotional analysis of how you... So if you can keep bleeping and blooping, I'll be able to figure that out more. Oh, that was terrible. Of course, we're the topic of this week's show, which you can see in your podcatcher of choice, is probably going to be machine learning, a big topic that you've probably seen on the cover of magazines and in Medium articles, and who knows where you're coming across it. Certainly, it's come up in tangentially on this show before. So we mention it, and I don't know that we have any business explaining it to, but so we have a special guest on who knows all about it, who is going, does have lots to say about it and lots of knowledge about it. So Paige Bailey, hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing great. Here in sunny, Seattle area. How are y'all?
We're doing good. So is it Seattle because Microsoft, yeah?
This is true. The entire Pacific Northwest is turned into basically the catcher of all the clouds, you know, and the Space Needle kind of looks like Cloud City, right? Like, so we've got Amazon, Google Cloud Platform, and Microsoft all kind of in the same general area.
It's Bespin.
And you quite literally are at Microsoft, right?
Yes. Well, actually, no. I'm in my kitchen right now. So if you see or hear any kitchen sounds, that might be it. Proximity to the coffee maker. That's the optimum location. Yep.
Okay. Fantastic. And I guess maybe I'll pass it to you, Dave, because this came about through you kind of hopping into a Twitter exchange, right?
Yeah. So I. Paige, if you'll remember, I was on the Twitter and I,
as one does.
I do about 20 times a day, but but I was like, I've been, you know, exposing myself to machine learning and developer tutorials, and everyone's like, oh, machine learning, AI, this will do that you do that, you plug into the neural network and then you get, you know, and everything was kind of like, you know, and then you take your model and then you put your data into the model and then bingo bango, you have a machine learn. And I didn't quite understand what was going on there. Cause for me, the noob question was sort of like, what's that artifact? Like I have a data set, you know, user data or whatever. And then like, what is the model I'm running it through? I didn't understand what that artifact was. Was it a JSON file, like a binary, some code? Like did it just write some Python for me in the background? You know, I didn't know like what it was. And you kind of helped explain it to me. And I think it was Sarah Drasner who like was like, you need to talk to Paige. And so and I think you kind of helped me understand how it is, but maybe for like the you know, novice, just and Joe human, how would you explain like what machine learning and artificial intelligence is like at a base level?
Right. So really there are two kind of camps of the machine learning buzzwords these days, right? Like there's deep learning and there's machine learning. And when you think about machine learning, I just want you to think about an equation, right? So a machine learning model is really just kind of a glorified equation. And the way I always like to think about it is, you know, back in the day, I think it was Leonardo da Vinci, right? Like he stood on top of a super duper tall building and he had like a ball and he dropped it from the tall building and he made a series of measurements. So he would time, you know, how long it took for the ball to drop, how long it took for like something slightly heavier to drop, the distance that was traveled, right? So he would have a height, he would have a time it took to reach the ground and go splat. You know, that was kind of the thing. And over time, he developed like this very, very large data set of, okay, I drop a thing, it takes this long to travel this distance. And when he looked at that data, he was able to kind of suss out, okay, well, now I understand how gravity works, or I understand like how if I drop something from a height, you know, it's going to be negative 9.8 t squared or whatever it is to hit the ground. And so that is a model, right? Like it's being able to predict what is going to happen based on something that you haven't seen yet. So you can think of a machine learning model as just kind of an equation that you can use to get a response from data that you input. So cool. Yeah. So I always like to say, like if you've done a line of best fit, right? Like, and you know y equals mx plus b, then you know, congratulations, that's machine learning. That's knowing for a given x as an input, you know what your y is going to be.
Okay, that's the Excel analogy.
That's the Excel analogy. So if you have like a whole bunch of data that you've been looking at in Excel, and you plot it onto, you know, one of the beautiful Excel data visualizations.
Okay.
Charts.
Yeah. So you know what you want in a way. Is that a part of this? Because sometimes it, I don't know, and apologize for my ignorance here, but sometimes like I have a data set and I want to like hold it in my hand and give it to you and say, I would like some free insight from this data, please.
Gotcha.
That's not how it works, right? Because I didn't ask you for anything.
So there are a couple of different nuances to that, right? So if you already know what you're looking for, that's something called a classification task. So that means that your data has already been labeled. You already kind of understand like what the characteristics should be. If you're just trying to, so say you have a whole bunch of high school students that you randomly sample and you ask them what they like to do, like what their hobbies are.
I'm already afraid of what they're going to say, but go ahead.
Well, I'm going to base this on like 1980s, you know, Breakfast Club era sort of thing.
Yeah. Saved by the Bell.
I like Walkman and tacos.
Yeah. So like if you ask them characteristics about themselves, there's like, oh man, I like to play sports. You know, I like hanging out with my bros or whatever. You could probably, you know, suss out that those people kind of hang out together. And then the people who like play instruments and, you know, like that sort of are in bands or whatever, they're probably in another little cluster. And then there's another cluster of people who are like theater kids and really like Velvet Underground. And like, and that's, so you could kind of infer different groups. And that's clustering. So you don't necessarily know the answer, but you can see that there are like these very specific groups kind of outlined in your data. So if it's something that you already know, like a credit card loan default or a bank loan default, so you know that people either did or they didn't, that's a classification task. If you're just trying to infer out groups from a data set, that's more of just a clustering sort of task. And those two groups are supervised and unsupervised machine learning.
Oh, really? Which one is the classification? Is supervised?
Yes.
And unsupervised is the clustering stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if like a kid, then like you have a data set and you find out like kids like to read books and kids like to smoke cigarettes, they're probably trending towards being a drama kid. That's sort of the like how the clustering works. Is that
yes,
right?
That's perfectly correct. So, but the other thing that's important to note though is that it takes a human to do that that sort of clustering, right? Like you can't throw a whole bunch of data at the computer and say, "Hey, computer, figure out the meaning that I don't know yet." Like you have to have a person to kind of understand what those clusters might mean and if they make sense. So
the example we kind of talked about on Twitter was, you know, if you have a data set of dogs, like dog pictures in a dog breed,
yes,
like this is a Labrador, this is a Golden Retriever, you can kind of like run those through the computer,
yeah,
and it creates that model, or that, I guess, what is that, what it's called, a model?
Yes.
I want to do the terminology.
Yeah.
Okay. It'll create a model of like dog pictures to dog breeds. And then the kind of thing is, I will now give it a new dog picture, of my dog, which is kind of a mixed breed, and it will try to guess what breed of dog it is, right? With like a confidence score. That's kind of what you
yes.
said.
Yes. So that would be a deep learning example. Probably.
Oh, so now we're into deep.
Yeah. So probably something called deep transfer learning, because the existing model, for TensorFlow or for CNTK or whatever your model is of choice, it probably already knows, what a dog is. But what you would be doing is trying to train it on what kind of breed of dog. So it's kind of like building on top of an existing model. But that would definitely be deep learning.
And then if I like, so here I'm going to try to gotcha the computer. Mm-hmm. If I upload a picture of my cat, does it say like, oh, I'm 0.02% sure that's a dog? Or like, does it try to make it a dog, or does it say like, oh, I don't actually, that's not a dog at
that,
all?
That would be precisely it. If you uploaded a picture of a cat, just in general, the algorithm, if it already knew what was a dog and what was a cat, it would say, I don't really think that that's a dog. Like, I have a very, very low percent surety that that would be a dog. However, if you trained a model and, you know, tagged all of your cat pictures as dogs, then your model would think that a cat was a dog because that's what it's been told. Does that make sense?
It sounds like the training is a big deal.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's why, so if you, there are these things called cognitive services offered from Microsoft, and there are similar products offered from Amazon and from Google. So have you guys played with cognitive services by any chance, or?
No.
Alrighty.
I'm afraid not.
So I get to tell you about it. That's awesome. So, this is just a REST API call that you can use, that does all sorts of nifty deep learning stuff. And there are dozens of them readily available. So like an example would be, I could upload a picture of my face and it would say, all right, I know that this is a woman. It will try to guess my age. It will say what color my hair is. It will tell you what my emotion is with some sort of confidence level. Just a ton of information about just a random picture that you send into this REST API call. And that's because Google, Microsoft, and Amazon have trained deep learning models on this enormous corpus of data. And they've made it kind of like ready to use, so you don't have to go through that training process yourself.
I think I've heard of that, because this was another Sarah Drasner thing, is I think she made a demo not too long ago that was, because, you know, our audience, the people listening to the show, there's a lot of front-end developers out there, and
right,
a lot of them care about accessibility. And one of those classic things is, I have an image tag in my HTML, so image source equals dog.jpg. It's all too sadly common for a developer, person writing that markup, to leave off the alt text, which is an accessibility foul. But imagine a world in which I, you know, I see some missing alt text here. Why don't I send that dog picture to this API, get back from it a description of it, hopefully, and I'll check that in the alt text, and I've saved the day accessibility-wise.
Absolutely.
Kind of interesting.
And that was a cognitive services call. And the cool thing is about it is, and I can send you some examples of studies that I've done with the cognitive services, but it's 10 lines of code. Like, it is incredibly simple to do. All you have to do is point the algorithm at a URL, and you're good to go.
that's interesting. So I think that's worth talking about is that it's 10 lines of code, and that's very appealing, and the API usage is wonderful there. But I wonder if this is an opportunity to inject some of the, like, but what if scenarios or things to worry about potentially? Like, it's 10 lines of code and a bucket of trust.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
Can you expand on that?
And also you're kind of sacrificing... you're sacrificing knowing precisely the internals of how the algorithm is working and what data it's been trained on. So, so an example, of something that, that very, recently came into the news, right, was that there are certain races that are better classified than others. So for example, if you upload a picture of like a 30 something white man, it's probably going to give you a better characterization of that person's emotion and age than if you upload a picture of you know, a woman from a different country, who's in her 20s, right? And that's just because the data that's available to be training that algorithm is more skewed towards a specific demographic. So it's really...
Wow. So it's all about the training. It's not... So we have that article here in the show notes as well. It's a New York Times article. And it's not... The blame here is on the data set and on the training.
Absolutely.
And it has nothing to do with camera sensors or anything like that. It is a data problem.
It is absolutely a data problem. And it's the responsibility of the deep learning and the machine learning engineers as they're building out these models to make sure that their data sets are a representative sample and not including any sort of bias.
I guess, like, not to go full Black Mirror here.
No, please do.
But I guess, like, what, you know... Yeah. How do we know, like if these services, I imagine, you know, we talked a couple episodes ago about the like Wired article about Alipay and how Alipay is a, you know, Alibaba gives you a credit score in China, basically. And it like, basically their algorithm determines your future in some ways, you
absolutely.
Know, like how, and I don't have access to Alipay's data seed, mm-hmm. like their training data, I don't think. But like, I'm just kind of like, how, if these algorithms are kind of affecting our lives, you know, and we don't have the data, how do we know? And then in this one, kind of the follow-up is, how do we fix it? I mean, can I just retrain my computer with better data and then it also knows how to go back and fix all its mistakes? How does it,
those are like, five really big, awesome questions. And it's a lot, a lot to unpack too, right? So an example would be the credit score example you gave, and then also something like insurance, right? So based on a person's medical history or maybe their family demographics, what they should be paying for medical insurance. There's another great example of there's this thing, a test that prisoners are given that determines whether or not they should be placed up for parole. And the questions that they ask in this test are everything from like, do you have a college degree, to were your parents divorced, to do you know anybody who's been through the prison system before? And all of those things are outside of that inmate's control, right? And moreover, they're more prevalent in certain demographics than others, right?
Yeah, I think like, do you know a gang member?
Yeah,
like somebody who grew up like literally in a
wow.
Certain
and you
part
know
of Houston,
by marking which, yes on that yeah. thing, the algorithm is gonna not let you be paroled.
Pretty much, and so. As we give more and more sort of control of our lives to algorithms, you're sort of sacrificing the human aspect of that decision making process, right? Like you're necessarily biasing against some groups, and I think that's awful. So a solution is you know, attempting to add additional legislation to make it so that any of the algorithms that make those sort of, you know, life and death or life changing decisions are open sourced. And so are at least the parameters or the categories of the data that they're using. Because like it would be awful, right? Like if universities kind of do this already, you know, they make decisions about who should be accepted or not based on these very specific criteria. And you know, it's not really representative of who that person is, right?
Yeah, it reminds me of this book that we've talked about a couple of times in the show, Kathy O'Neill's Weapons of Math Destruction.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's good. And she mentions in it that aspect of it. This is new to me that there's legislation to open source algorithms, but that's certainly a good idea, because then there's some insight into how they work and that they can be corrected.
Right. And so there's not legislation yet, but it's a proposal that if you are using algorithms to make these life-changing decisions, then open source the logic behind those algorithms. And so or at least kind of your methodology for going about creating it. And so that's
I would support it in a minute.
Same.
Yeah. Well, I think that's great for public services. I think, like, you know, it comes down to like the businesses too. You know, Facebook obviously is like, oh, you like this kind of content? I'm going to keep serving you more of this kind of content. And like, we're kind of seeing like, you know, political radicalization, both the left and right. I mean, I have an experience where I went to YouTube and I watched one conservative viewpoint, and then I watched another, like, you know, oh, the guy who gave that conservative viewpoint takes down a feminist. And I watched like 2 minutes of that just because I was like, how on earth did this guy who I liked like end up on this title? And then my YouTube stream went like full alt-right for like a day or a weekend. And I just was like, like, how do I undo this? You know, but is YouTube also, do they have to open source their data set or their algorithm? I don't, how's that?
So I would love to see, sort of the logic behind creating, you know, YouTube's recommended video stream. I don't know how that would work in terms of legislation. But I do know, do you remember that example we were talking about a little bit earlier with the high school students, and you have kind of the characteristics of what these people like and what they don't like, and you can kind of artificially sort them into clusters?
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So like jocks or preps or theater kids or whatever.
Freaks.
Yes,
and geeks.
Absolutely. Also a great show. But there are some people like Lindsay Weir in the show, right, who might be smart and trying to fit in with the freaks, but she doesn't necessarily fall into any of one of those clusters. And what the YouTube algorithm is attempting to do, right, is attempting to kind of force people to be more present in those clusters, to be more defined by those clustering situations, right? So that
she likes one Led Zeppelin video, and then all of a sudden it's all, yeah.
Yeah.
Another obvious one is the, like, I'm even looking at Weapons of Math Destruction right now on Amazon. And of course, below it is the classic, you know, products related to this item. Customers who bought this also bought.
Yeah.
That's in this bucket, certainly, right? It's like, this is a classic, like, I build websites, I want to use machine learning. This is a way you can do that.
Yeah. And so the Amazon is basically one giant algorithm, right? And it's really interesting to try to figure out, like, what kind of algorithms the different websites are using to make their product recommendations. There's something called market basket analysis. And what it does is it basically, you have all of the Instacart data, and you do have all of the Instacart data. It's been open sourced. It's freely available for download and to play with. But you have, you know, people's purchase histories. And you might be able to see, like, oh, you know, people who buy bread and milk and cheese are very, very likely to also purchase butter or something.
Yep.
And so you, sure. Yeah. And so you can make the recommendation to people who have those things already in their cart. Like, hey, do you want to purchase butter too? Because you can see through history that those are commonly purchased items. There's actually a great academic paper that was I forget when. I think it was in like 2010 timeframe. But it shows that people who purchase diapers are super likely to purchase beer as well. So like,
amen to that.
Wow. Yeah. So you can find all of these weird, you know, combinations, right? So I'd love to see like, oh, if somebody purchases a unicorn onesie on Amazon, what else are they likely to purchase? Like,
it's fascinating stuff. And it makes sense that Amazon, as big of a company as they are, they write this for themselves. They have a million engineers and they do this. But I have a little e-commerce shop and I don't. So is there just like GitHub repos full of this stuff? Like this is of customers who also bought machine learning thing.
Oh, yeah.
It digests your sales data and it gets, so, why do people don't need to rewrite this every time?
Oh, right? Absolutely not. And I would argue that probably a lot of the algorithms that are being used for these companies are probably just ones that are freely available through open source. Like in Python, the most typically used machine learning library is something called scikit-learn. And it has like hundreds of algorithms that you can use and great examples of what those algorithms do. So everything from logistic regression to sort of the market basket analysis that I was talking about before, to support vector machines, to basically anything that you would want that is a machine learning algorithm. So that's cool. R has a ton of algorithms freely available as well. The most commonly used package is called Caret. So Caret. And then for deep learning, the most popular frameworks obviously are TensorFlow, PyTorch. And then Microsoft has one called CNTK. But yeah, TensorFlow is so widely used.
So I love that. That's very helpful to know that there's all these, you know, packages to kind of use on our own data, because it's not at odds with, but it's different than thinking of machine learning as, oh, that's an API that Microsoft provides for us that we can use. It's like sometimes, yeah, when the data set is absolutely massive and they're the ones who are, you know, kind of capable of giving it the training that it needs and stuff, but it doesn't have to be. I can BYO data.
Right. And so the thing that I always like to mention is that if you have a highly specialized use case, so like say you're a cranberry farmer in Nebraska, or where are cranberries grown? Are they grown in Washington?
Like, Wisconsin's got a lot of it.
Wisconsin.
How about a rose grower in Phoenix, Arizona, since that's what my father.
Oh, that's so cool. That's perfect. So
I will, because I'm doing market research at the
moment. Excellent. Yeah. Go ahead. So if you are a rose grower in Phoenix, Arizona, and you want to estimate how much fertilizer that you should use in July, that's probably a custom model that you would want to build yourself, right? So you would probably take in things like temperature and precipitation data, the amount of sunlight that the plant would get, and then that would all go into to estimating the fertilizer requirements.
Wouldn't it be, and crucially, what I did and how well it worked, like results would be nice to have too.
Yes. Right?
Like I did, here's all the numbers of what I did, but all the roses died.
Historical,
so don't use
historical
those
yield.
So you would obviously have to have historical data to base the machine learning algorithm on. That would be the path forward. But if you have a huge corpus of images, and you're just trying to pick out which ones have dogs, then you could probably use, like you said, one of the REST APIs from either Microsoft or from Google or from Amazon.
So this custom data set is interesting in that. So let's say it really is rose gardening. It's not infeasible that somebody would want to do that. Mm-hmm. Like, let's let computers solve this fertilization problem.
Yeah.
But I only got 3 years of data. You would assume that most machine learning people would be like, eh, that's probably not enough, right? What do you need, 100 years, 10 years, 30 years?
So you'd be surprised. It's actually very dependent on the problem. There are examples of machine learning algorithms that work quite well with just like 50 records, 50 examples. Mm. There are some that, you know, you need a little bit more, like 200 to 300. But for the most part, like the more data is, you know, the better, obviously.
Sure.
But it's highly dependent on your problem and what you're trying to figure out.
And I guess how much of a math whiz do I need to be to interpret this data? Because I'm looking at Scikit right now at scikit-learn.org, and I'm in the examples, and it's like plotting cross-validated predictions, isotonic regression, full phase completion with a multi-output estimator. And I'm just like, I'm starting to glaze over here. And I guess, like, is math your background, are you programming background and you've picked up all the math, or how does, I guess, what tools do I need to interpret this data?
Gotcha. So I'll answer the background question first. For undergrad, I did geophysics and applied math. And then,
we all did. and then
did some graduate work in carbonate geology and computer science. So my background is very math and physics focused. But you don't have to know that in order to be successful at using machine learning algorithms, I would say. So the stuff that's already been created as part of scikit-learn, as part of Carrot, as part of TensorFlow, if you're just kind of like calling those libraries, it's the same as, you know, calling any library, right? Like if I'm calling something in Python or something in R called Shiny, Shiny generates a web application for me, right? Like I can, you know, write 100 lines of code, and then suddenly I've got a web app that does data visualization that's interactive. I have no clue how it's generating that web app, right? Like it's HTML, it's CSS, it's JavaScript, it's magic. Like, but I have a thing that I can pointy clicky and like make the data go wow, right? Like, and that's awesome. Mm-hmm. But like I said, I'm calling this library. I have no idea how it's working. So it's the same. So you can take your data, and as long as you understand what question you're trying to solve and what algorithm you should be using, you don't necessarily have to know about the internals of how that algorithm is optimizing, you know, memory utilization or like running through some of the mechanics of or the mathematics. You can just kind of call it and use it. And like, I would say that if every single deep learning engineer had to know the internals of TensorFlow, and how a TPU, a tensor processing unit, which is the specialized hardware that Google just recently released, how it precisely is optimized for that software, then we would have like two. We would have like two deep learning engineers.
Sure. Like you can be good at CSS without knowing like how much RAM is necessary to paint this box to the screen or whatever. There's always like a little mystery behind the scenes, even if you're quite good at using a technology.
Absolutely. So it's, I would say that if you're using scikit-learn, Carrot, TensorFlow, whatever, you don't have to be super adept at math. If you're using the REST API call, you don't have to, all you have to know is how to read a confidence estimate. And that's like, oh, 0.95, that means you're 95% confident. Okay, that makes sense.
Do you like video games? Are you too busy to play all the video games in your backlog? Then you might enjoy a new podcast I recently started with my friend Yan Wang called A Side Quest. It's a video games podcast for people too busy to play video games. Yan and I are both web developers, so each episode is like a weekly stand-up, but for video games. Join us as we work our way through our lists of shame. A Side Quest, like Side Quest, but it's a pun using the aside element. Get it? Available now on iTunes, Spotify, or by visiting asidequest.simplecast.fm. So I guess my next question is how would I, if I have this set of data, like a group of users, how would I start, like, I don't know, doing like classification? I'm thinking of like CodePen users, and maybe like you just like, what are the like clicks in CodePen, like the groups of people who follow each other or whatever? Like, how would I, could I like kind of visualize these groups and figure out their interests? Like, or, you know, if you think about like Twitter or something, could you like take all of Twitter's data, visualize these groups, and then like eliminate entire Russian botnets? You know, like, is that something? How would I start
doing? So you could. That would probably be a social network analysis. To kind of for the Twitter thing, right? So mm-hmm. just like seeing which groups of people talk to each other and which ones follow each other, that sort of thing. Probably the following thing would be easier to do. So if Twitter wanted to eliminate botnets that all kind of follow each other, they absolutely could. It's just a matter of having, you know, the motivation to do so. If you wanted to do, kind of characteristics of CodePen users, right? So like, which people, in general follow the same individuals or have looked at the same examples, you could, provided you had the data. Right. And you would have a couple of options there. You could do clustering based on kind of the topics or who they follow, or you could do the market basket analysis thing that I was referring to before, which is kind of like, oh, if they follow these three people, and you know, typically if people follow these three people, they follow this other one, you could make that recommendation. But it really, the thing that you need the most is the data. If you don't have that, then you're kind of up a creek.
Cool. So it's probably, I don't know, I don't mean to put words in anybody's mouth, but it's probably more likely to have data than be doing interesting things with it. I think that's certainly our case at CodePen. We have loads of data and kind of need some ideas of what to do with it, or need the tools to know what to do with it. And we use it in a couple of interesting ways now. There's one like internal tool that we have that is a little bit heavyweight. So I don't think we expose it to everybody yet, but it's like show me similar stuff. So it uses some kind of magic to look at the code and dates and metadata and who you are and stuff and show other things that have been created that are like it in some way. And I don't even know what the algorithm is, but it does it. Another common one is that we need to look for spam. So we try to do some kind of grouping analysis stuff to be like, this is a thing that looks like spam. And it could be as easy as it matches this string. They use some spammy URL in there. But it'd be nice to be able to be like, this is not only, this one is definitely spam, but this one looks like this one. So it's probably spam too.
Yeah. It would also be really interesting to see for CodePen, I think, like which visualizations generated other visualizations. So they do that. Mm. Yeah. They do that for malware now in sort of the security space, and that so most viruses that are created, right, are just like people hanging out on the dark web and copying others' code, right? And then like the malware detection software recognizes, you know, one particular virus, and it's like, okay, no more access for you. But the hackers realize that if they just change it in a very, very minute way, suddenly it's, you know, it can get into your computer again. So there have been studies shown that like most of the viruses, you know, they're only like a couple hundred or something, like not that many. But they've been, you know, tweaked and modified so much that they've created these like families of viruses that are constantly, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. It's really interesting to see, right? So it would be kind of cool to like know that you have this one content creator who created something on CodePen, and then like a million people, you know, copy pasted it or forked it and made minor tweaks. So even though it was like this one content creator, it spawned like 1,000 other visualizations.
That would be neat to know, because there are those different, in fact, that's why our similar thing exists at all, is we struggled with it early on, is somebody would copy and paste somebody else's work, and then we'd see that copy and be like, this is so cool, and we'd feature it, because we have this concept of featuring pens on the homepage of CodePen and projects and all the other stuff. But that was a problem, because the original creator wasn't getting the credit, it was somebody else who copied and pasted, and the copying and pasted isn't illegal or even breaks our our usage policy, because everything's open source on here. You're free to copy and paste whatever you like. But I'd like to give credit to the original owner. So this similarity algorithm stuff was intended to let us know when we're looking at something that this algorithm thinks isn't the original.
Right.
Which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But I'd like to get even more value out of this stuff if I could. You know, if we're analyzing users, is there ways that anybody could look at their user data and be like, you know what, that user right there, they're likely to upgrade in the next 3 days. They're just ripe for the picking or something, you know, like a business value kind of thing. That would be kind of neat.
Absolutely. Like, and you can definitely detect that. So there's knowing how to get customers, so characteristics of people who are about to purchase. There's also kind of the opposite, right, which is guessing when people are about to leave. So that's something called churn analysis. And there are several algorithms that are specialized to detect that too, because there's all of those services companies, so cable and telephone and whatnot. They figured out that if they have a customer leave after a certain amount of time, it actually doesn't like help them break even in terms of, you know, what value that customer brought to the company. So they're very invested in making sure that if a person has like warning signs of, you know, leaving a particular service, they show up in the email saying like, oh, hey, you know, here's $20 off your next bill or something. So being able to catch those warning signs is really cool.
That's super valuable business stuff. It feels a little, some of it is feels gray area-y to be like, you have been algorithmically identified as an excellent customer, so I'm going to market at you harder.
Yeah.
But hey.
Or market at them more effectively, right? So another example of a creepy algorithm is there's something called geofencing. So say I have a North Face app downloaded to my phone. And the North Face app is, you know, constantly running in the background. If I walk past a North Face store, the app can detect, the lat long coordinates of where I am. And it could send me like a push notification to the effect of, hey, here's 20% off a snowboarding gear. Right as I walk past the store, because it can tell that I'm in that geographic location. And the funny thing is too, right, is like we all pretty much use social media. We've all purchased things from Amazon. Those companies sell the data. So if I say, you know, on Facebook, I really like snowboarding, or if I've purchased snowboarding gear before, then the North Face probably knows that I like snowboarding. So it can say, you know, 20% off snowboarding gear as opposed to like 15% off spelunking gear or something. Though I would probably like spelunking gear too. But yeah.
I like that. I mean, I don't know. When this stuff is associated with kind of free business value, it's kind of no wonder people are stoked about it. This stuff makes our products better sometimes. I mean, we certainly have to be careful. We have to think about social implications or any kind of implications it brings to our stuff. But the potential for good is high.
Yeah. The only thing that I would be concerned about, though, is again, kind of that bubble effect that you were mentioning before, right? Is like, if North Face is only marketing snowboarding stuff to me, right? Because that's what it knows I like. Then, you know, I'm going to be a snowboarder forever, as opposed to, you know, going out and purchasing a kayak or something.
Yeah.
I think I heard Josh Clark kind of quote Kathy O'Neill. Kathy, is that right? Yes. Okay, just kind of like, if we train our computers based on the past, like they can only anticipate, like, or if we train them to predict the future based on the past, they can only predict the past.
Kind of
like it's that she likes snowboarding. So let's just sell her snowboarding and it's like doesn't like anticipate that you would want to shift forward in your or move into mountain biking or move into spelunking.
Yeah. Like machine learning algorithms and AI, they'll never make history, right? Like they're incapable of making those, they're incapable of having those completely unexpected, like Elon Musk sending a car into space sort of moments, right? Like they,
or even the iPhone. I mean, it's like the Razr is the most popular thing. Let's, you know, procedurally generate a phone that looks exactly like the Razr or something.
Absolutely.
You know, it would have never had an iPhone. So I guess that's like, I mean, with all this, it's a great tool, but is it, you know, especially with those like societal ramifications, like do we kind of, is it a danger, I guess, to rely on it too much? Or
I think we should all be very, very cautious and very mindful and attempt to build better tools to make sure that whatever algorithms that we create aren't doing any unintended harm. So I think that that's going to be increasingly important. And either if that's either through legislation or like specialized certifications that data practitioners have to have, or like any sort of, you know, peer reviewed process for algorithm creation, I think that those will all be increasingly important. But I think too that it's a huge opportunity. And we'll always have to rely on human beings to be creative. And it's going to become increasingly important for human beings to be creative and inquisitive and curious and ask all the great questions, right?
Kind of, I think I asked it earlier, but I asked like 10 questions. But like, if the computer was wrong, how do we fix the computer? And how does it fix its mistakes?
Right. So throughout the training process, right, you'll be getting back performance metrics on how your algorithm is doing. So it'll say something like, oh, you know, like the random forest that you just trained was able to classify correctly, you know, 80% of your data. And you could say like, oh, well, that's not really, you know, I don't really feel comfortable with that metric. Let's try tweaking it a little bit in order to try to improve that accuracy. So you keep tuning it, you keep tweaking it, you change the hyperparameters, and eventually it gets to like 92% accurate, and you're like, "That's awesome! I think that's great. Let's go for that." Even though that algorithm works correctly today at 92%. Confidence on the test data that you submit, you still might need to change it in a month because, you know, new data, and it's no longer sort of representative of what your user profile looks like. So,
okay. So it's like, these are like machines we have to kind of maintain too.
Absolutely.
Like we have to change the oil on the robot, the predictive button.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there are some things, right, that probably won't ever or will change very slowly. So dogs, right? Like a picture of a dog and a picture. Dogs probably aren't going to evolve super duper quick. So if a dog looks like a dog in a picture today, the dog pictures of 20 years from now will probably still look like the dogs of today. But for example, fashion, right? Like fashion changes very rapidly, or user demographic profiles. So again, let's use that North Face example, right? Like what are people buying in the spring versus what are people buying in the winter, right? Like, so if you want to recommend swimsuits and water gear, you know, you probably shouldn't be doing it in December.
What are some more, I saw this another article that's somewhat recently, speaking of Twitter and how much Twitter stuff we've talked about today, that they rolled out some new thing that had to do with images. And it looked like one of those like algorithmic things that figures out what's interesting about a photo. So if, let's say you have a photo of a wide variety of aspect ratios, but in your app, you need to display images always at the same aspect ratio, like a square or a little rectangle or something. Certainly you can just crop it. And there's been image libraries around forever that can say, just take this image and crop it, or crop it from the bottom right, top left, center, something. But wouldn't it be more interesting if it cropped it based on some XY coordinate on the image that was algorithmically determined to be interesting? And I think that it's done and out. They used it. That is in this bucket, right? That's an example of machine learning kind of doing something useful for us.
Absolutely. And I can point you to some of the academic papers that were used to make those little bounding box rectangles, right? So like if you have, you know, a picture of you and like six friends, and you upload it to Facebook, it probably will center your profile picture square recommendation around you, regardless of how many people are in the image.
Cool.
Yeah.
Kinda.
Yeah, kinda. and it's doing that by like, so first it would probably detect the faces, right? So say you have six people and one of them's you, it'll detect the faces. And then it'll try to detect who is in those faces. And it'll be like, oh, that's Paige Bailey, you know, so let's center the square around Paige Bailey's head. And so,
right.
Yeah. And so the REST APIs that I was mentioning before, the ones that you can, you know, call with 10 lines of code, they already do that too. So if you wanted to do the auto generation of those specific aspect ratios, you could, using just a REST API call and not a custom algorithm. And the other thing that should probably be mentioned, again, with the REST API call thing, like, say you have a company, and everybody, you know, has an employee profile picture that's included on LinkedIn or on their email or whatever. There's already a REST API version of a deep learning algorithm that once you train it on that data set, like with just, you know, like five images of the person's face, it can say with some confidence level that, yes, this is, I see a face and it's Dave, or I see a face and it's Chris.
This is random, but I just happened to, just as we do prep for episodes, have your LinkedIn profile up, which has, I believe, your face with a rectangle around it that's been algorithmically identified, and then like JSON data of your like level of happiness and anger and disgust is pretty funny.
Yep. And that's the thing that I was mentioning before. The response that you get back is just JSON, with all of that data included.
And so, well, the faces over time will probably be okay to detect and stuff. But as you mentioned, it's relevant to the last thing we talked about, in that if all of a sudden the fashion of the future had us all wearing like crazy banana hats, it's gonna wreak havoc on our algorithms.
Yeah, there's actually so one of the coolest things to me at least is something called adversarial machine learning. And that's basically like, okay, an algorithm's been created. Now, how can I mess with it? Like, what is the minimum amount that I have to do in order to make that algorithm not perform the way it's supposed to? So there are makeup companies, and websites that you can go to that are like, oh, hey, if you want to make your face invulnerable to like doing this sort of face detection, here's how you should place your makeup so that, you know, a computer can no longer recognize your face. Or here's how you should style your hair to make it so that a computer can no longer recognize that, you know, it's looking at a human face.
Well, I'll probably make an appearance in the next James Bond film.
It's super cool, right? Like it's very interesting to see. And the other thing too, I don't want to get into it too awful bad, but there have been studies shown that if you introduce just a small amount of noise into images that you use for training data or for testing data, then suddenly your deep learning algorithm is no longer able to classify it correctly, and it has very high confidence that it's something else. So there was something circulating around wow. the internet a while ago that was like a turtle, and you know, they put the video image or picture image of the turtle into the deep learning algorithm, and the deep learning algorithm was like super, super sure that the turtle was a gun. Like, no matter which direction you turn the turtle, it just thought it was a gun. Wow. Yeah.
So if you're the type that likes to, you know, has a special thing in their wallet for blocking RFID or wears a tinfoil hat, you may consider adding a little filter on all the images you share publicly that adds noise to them, just so you can't be analyzed.
Pretty much.
And carrying around a turtle.
Also turtles. Yeah.
But think about that though, right? Like, what if, for example, airline security or concert security implemented video AI to try to detect if somebody was bringing a weapon in, and the poor person was just had their, you know, like their comfort turtle or their security turtle or whatever.
Sure.
And all of a sudden, you know, every cop in the place is swarming around them because they think they have a gun. Like, it's crazy.
It seems highly likely that, you know, whether that exact thing happens or not is up in the air, but it seems likely that stuff like that is just going to happen.
Absolutely.
We're headed toward a future where that seems a bit unavoidable. Well, you know, so this is big stuff. I happen to be at a URL, standuply.com/conferences, that apparently is tracking like conferences around the world that are happening that are related to machine learning and AI. And there are 240 of them this year.
Wow.
Around the world. So, yeah, this is one of those things, like, whatever you think about it, if you think it's stupid and a trend, you're welcome to have that thought, but when there's 240 conferences about anything happening over a year, you better believe it's something to watch.
Yeah. And like you were mentioning before, it's just so valuable, right? Like if it's a great tool to be able to better serve customers, to be able to answer questions and to take data and actually do something with it. Like, I love it. I think it is the coolest thing. It's the closest thing to magic that you can do with programming.
Very cool. I think we'll wrap up soon. We're kind of hitting the mark. But I guess for Johnny or Susie, web developer out there, I guess how would you encourage them to get started experimenting?
Oh, so I love this website called DataCamp. It's datacamp.com, and it goes through every single process that you would be, that you might want to try for machine learning or data science or data manipulation. It starts from the ground up, with Python and R, and I highly recommend their entire curriculum. There are also two great courses on Coursera from this guy named Andrew Ng, who teaches at Stanford, used to work for Baidu. One called machine learning and the other one called deep learning. They're both specializations and they're both fantastic. And then also just like play around with those REST APIs that I was mentioning before. You can do so much with them. And they're just 10 lines of code that you can really, really easily add into your app. So if you want to learn more about the theory or like developing your own algorithms, do those first two things, the data camp and the Coursera classes. But if you just want to like throw some AI at a problem that's kind of generic, try out the REST APIs from either Azure, AWS, or GCP.
Wow, awesome. Well, thank you so much, Paige, for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. For people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do
that? Oh, well, I don't really want your money. I would love to hear your questions though. I am always available at dynamic webpage, page spelled like my name, via the Twitters. I'm dynamic webpage pretty much everywhere on the internet, actually. So GitHub, LinkedIn, Facebook, etc.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I know my interest is piqued, so thank you very much. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star heart favorite the show. That's how the machine learning algorithm boosts us in those content silos. So we really appreciate that. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you to program their robots. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.